All right, so please have a Bible open, and we're going to work our way through that interesting passage there now. Now, the Christian life is a life of service. It's a life of service where we serve God, but also where we serve others. And I just want to think for a moment now, for your own life, is there anything that's really stopping you from living that life of service? Think about your own life for a moment. Is there anything stopping you? Is there something that you could do, do you think, that could allow you to serve God more in your current situation? Something you could do in your life to allow you, you know, some change in situation to allow you to serve God more? Well, that's what we're looking at today. When we look at this, that this is a discussion about how we serve God and the best way to serve God, and do we need to change our situation to serve God. That's what we're looking at in this chapter. So let's have a look at how it begins in verse 1. The Apostle Paul writes to this church at Corinth and he says, "Now for the matters you wrote about." So what we actually have here in this letter of the Corinthians is a letter that the Apostle Paul has written to the Corinthians after they have written a letter to him. They've written a letter to him with all these questions, and now he's writing back an answer. But please notice something. We're at chapter 7. We're at chapter 7. It's taken chapters 1 to 6 to actually answer all these things that they didn't bring up. Let me just give you a bit of an overview as to what actually happened in the first large section of this letter. In chapters 1 to 4, we saw that there were gross divisions in the church, where people were despising other people and thinking, "You're not strong enough, you're not smart enough, I'm a better Christian than you because I'm smarter, stronger, come from a better family." That was happening in chapters 1 to 4. In chapters 5, there was a Christian there who was having sex with his stepmother. In chapter 6, there were members of the church who were taking other members of the church to court and suing them publicly. And the second half of chapter 7, we see that there were members of the church who thought that their body didn't really matter. What they did with their body, it just didn't matter, and so they could go to prostitutes because, well, our body's just going to rot. So it doesn't matter what we do with our body. They were breaking God's commands in many ways. And yet, they didn't think that any of those things were important to write to Paul about. Paul has answered those questions, or he's answered those issues that he's found out from other sources. And, you know, sometimes we can be like them, can't we? There can be glaringly obvious things that we need to address that we just never actually get around to addressing. I guess for some people they might complain about certain things, and all the time they actually haven't got their relationship to God sorted out yet. And they might think other things are important when actually they need to become Christians. They need to get forgiveness of sins first before they worry about other things. But this church, they've written this letter to Paul and he doesn't ignore what they've said. He now deals with it. So let's have a look at it in verse 1. "Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to marry." It is good for a man not to marry. This seems to be the issue that they've brought up. Literally it actually says it's good for a man not to touch a woman. And it's referring there, I believe, to the sexual relationship that comes in marriage. And this is what they're saying to Paul. They've said, you know, is it good for a man to not be married? Is it good for a man to be celibate? How does that work? You know, is it good not to get married? And it seems that they're saying that it is good. And so Paul, when he gives this answer here, he's actually writing about marriage. He's going to explain the place of marriage in the Christian life. But remember that he's writing to a real mixed congregation. There are some who it seems are saying a man shouldn't touch a woman, but then there are others in the church who are going to prostitutes and going to their stepmother. So it's a real mix of a situation that he's trying to write to. But their issue is, you know, how do we serve God? Do we serve God by not having any sex at all, by not getting married? What's the best way to do it? So let's have a look at Paul's answer and he'll explain marriage and serving God for us. Verses 1 and 2 again. "Now for the matters you wrote about. It is good for a man not to marry. But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband." So here we see Paul's answer. He starts off with the quote that it is good not to marry, and he'll explain that for us later. But he says that each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. Now this is going against what they've suggested. They've been saying that you shouldn't have sex, that sex is maybe unclean or something like that, and that it's going to stop you from serving God. But Paul's actually saying, no, marriage and having your own wife, your own husband, will actually help you to serve God. Now, why is this the case? Well, it's because it's going to allow you to express your God-given sexual desires in the right way. Okay, it'll allow you to express your God-given sexual desires in the right way, and so it will actually stop you from sin and temptation. The reason he gives there is because there is so much immorality. Because there's so much immorality around, each man should have his own wife, each woman her own husband. That's particularly true of this church at Corinth, as we've seen in chapters 1 and 6, but it's equally true in our society today, that immorality is prevalent around us. Just think about the advertising that we have in our world today and how much sex is used to sell things. And it's very often used to sell things for which sex has got no relationship to it. It can be an ice cream, and sex is used to sell an ice cream. I've seen sex used to sell a car part. Right? It can be used anywhere. But then think about our newspapers and our magazines. Here's some of the media, Dolly magazine. I was reading this the other day. It's got Guy Sebastian in it. And when you look at that, it's all about experimenting and being comfortable and doing what's safe. And while it doesn't go out and just say, be immoral, it's certainly not saying the other way. It's covering all bases. And it's interesting that I was looking at the survey they had in here. They got a sex survey for girls 14 to 16 or 18. And it said here that over half of the girls who responded believe that people should live together before they get married. That's over half the young people who read this type of magazine. Now see, that's the world in which you live, where it's okay just to live together and have sex before you get married. But it was also interesting in the survey that under the title of If I Could Turn Back Time, that 48% said that they regretted having sex before they got married. So that's interesting, isn't it? So there they are. The magazine sort of, it's not that they promote it, but they encourage it subtly. Yet half of the girls who go down that track regret it. Yet the magazine keeps doing it. Now why is that the case? Because they want to make money out of you. See, the Dolly magazine, they're not actually interested in the welfare of young girls. They're interested in making money out of young girls. It's same with the men's magazines, the Clio magazines. Their role is to make money. And they will stir up your natural God-given desires for fellowship and sex and all the things that God gives. They'll stir that up. Not for your good, but to make money out of it. You see, Dolly's actually not in the business of trying to encourage Christian girls to live a Christian life. And, you know, Playboy magazine, they're not really in the business of trying to encourage young Christian men to live the Christian life. You may not know that, but that's actually true. They're not interested in trying to help you to live a Christian life. They're trying to make money out of you. See, it's prevalent around us. Think about the entertainment on TV. It's often got that immoral edge to it. In fact, it's normal just for people to go somewhere, fall in love, and go and have sex, which of course is a form of immorality because we believe in marriage. But that's just the normal entertainment. That's just all around us. You know, and you just get used to it because it's just in every movie, it's on the TV, it's just everywhere. More than that, it's also in our education system because the education system does not say wait till you get married. The education system in our schools, in our universities, actually says, do whatever's right for you. Whatever that's going to mean, do whatever's right for you. See, that it's in the education as well. And it's the example of our friends, our relatives, of the people around us. Most of my relatives have just moved in with their girlfriends. Most of my friends have just moved in with their girlfriends. The leaders in our society approve of this behaviour. You see, it's in our advertising, our media, they make money out of us from it, it's in our entertainment, our education, it's the example, it's the leaders. Immorality is all around us. And so for that reason, every man should have his own wife and every woman her own husband. Because marriage will actually protect us. Marriage will actually stop us being tempted in ways that we shouldn't and allow us to express our God-given sexual desires in a right way. And so look at verses 3 to 5. We see the duty that comes to care for each other in marriage. This is how a husband and wife look after each other and help each other live the godly life. This is how it works. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and the wife likewise... Sorry, I'll go back. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. You see, there is a duty that a husband has to his wife and that a wife has to her husband to look after each other sexually. It may be slightly differently in how it works itself out for each partner, but there's a responsibility that each one has. The husband or the wife cannot deprive either of their spouse. It's just not allowed in Christianity. Now, verse 4 is an interesting one. It says here that the wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. The NIV, I just dared not actually translate what it literally says. I'll just read to you what it literally says, because it's easy to translate. It says, the woman does not have authority over her own body, but the man does. Likewise, the man over his own body does not have authority, but the woman does. And so it's a lot stronger than what it says there. It's saying that my body belongs to my wife, and her body belongs to me, and I am not free to use it except for her holiness. And she's not free to use it in any other way except for my holiness. All right? And so we actually see here the unbelievable equality that there exists in Christianity. You know how most people think in Christianity that the woman's meant to be the slave and everything's, you know, for the man and all this? But it's not like that at all. There's whatever Paul says of the man, he says it equally to the woman. And this is holy life. This is living the holy life in marriage. It's serving each other. I realise that some of you may have had bad sexual experiences, and so you may doubt marriage, but I want to say that sex within marriage is part of the godly Christian life, and it's how a husband and a wife help each other and help and actually save each other, because they keep each other from potential sins that they may encounter outside of marriage. And in verse 5 he says here that if you are going to abstain from sex, then you only do it for an agreed period of time. But then come back together so that your needs are met, and that way you won't be open to temptation and to sin. But look what it says in verse 6. He says, I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all men were as I am, but each one has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now you see, what Paul's saying here about getting married, it's not a command that he's giving. He'd like all people to be like himself, and we'll see in a moment that means that he was single. He'd like people to be single because when you're single, it actually means that you're a lot freer to serve in the church, to serve God's people, to serve God and to serve others. And so there's a great deal of freedom that comes with that. But he says it's a matter of giftedness. One man has this gift, another has that. It's a matter of giftedness. God gives different gifts, and one of the gifts that he gives is being single. And what we're going to look at now is Paul's going to tease this out for us about whether or not you choose the single life or whether or not you choose the married life. And I'll just show you the structure of this passage so you can see how it works. But in verses, and I've written this in your notes there, in verses 1 to 7, he's given us all this theory about marriage and giftedness. Then in verses 8 to 9, he's got his application of this to singles. Then in verses 10 to 11, his application of this to Christian married couples. And then in verses 12 to 16, his application to Christians who are married to a non-Christian. And then he gives some concluding remarks in verses 17 to 24. See how the structure fits? He gives his theory, three lots of application, and then a conclusion. Nice little section to get your mind around. And I point that out to you because I want you to be confident that the Bible is understandable. That if you do your hard work at seeing how it works and what it says, you can actually see very often just simple structures which make it very easy to understand. Let's have a look at the first one, though. The first application he gives to the single, verses 8 and 9. Now, to the unmarried and to the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I am. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. And so he's saying here, look, when you think about singleness and marriage, it's good to stay single. It is good. And you know, throughout the history of the church has been richly blessed by men and women who have chosen the single life in order to serve God and his people. And so there are many famous authors like John Stott, and John Stott was part of a group of men who chose the single life so they could serve the church. And those men have written important books and stood up for the truth and had a big impact on Western Christianity. But they chose to be single for Christ. We also see here that, although Christianity is often said to teach that women should be barefoot and pregnant, that's actually not the case. Here we see that Christianity was offering to women in the ancient world a valid option apart from marriage. And this would this type of singleness would involve learning the scriptures, so there was an education that came with this, and so that they were free from family life if they wanted to be. So that idea of being barefoot and pregnant, it's not a Christian idea. You can certainly be pregnant if you want to and be barefoot if that's what you want to do. That might be hot or something. That's fine. But it's not Christian to force women to do that. And I need to put it before you to consider this for yourself, whether or not you should be single or married. Now, for all of you, or for most of you here now, you are single at the moment, and so you need to live in an appropriate way. But you need to think about your life for God. Should I stay single, or should I get married, as we'll look at in a moment? Because there are plenty of people in our world today who don't get married. You know, not getting married in one sense is no big deal. Most people I know don't get married now. But they do it for the complete opposite reasons of the Bible. See, in the Bible, you don't get married so that you can serve God and serve others. Most of my friends who haven't got married do it because they don't want to have any responsibility. They don't want to serve anybody. They want to be able to do their own thing at their own time. And so that's the exact opposite reason of the Bible, isn't it? See, singleness in the world is completely different to singleness in the Bible. Paul's saying we do it so that we may serve other people. And the other point that was pointed out to me yesterday is that singleness actually may not be something that you do for the whole of your life. The gift of singleness may be something that you pray for while you are single. So while you are single and live in a world of immorality around you, you know, it's really good to pray for the gift of singleness so that you can live holy now before you get married. This, of course, assumes that that we want to use our time wisely and that we want to serve other people. He's saying be single so you can serve. And of course, he's assuming that we actually do want to serve people. And I hope you want to serve people, that you do want to serve God and you want to serve others. But verse 9, it can sort of sound negative, can't it? Let's look at this. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. And you can look at that and it makes marriage sound fairly second rate, doesn't it? I mean, we've got to be honest about it. If you burn with passion, get married then. Get married. And it's almost like, you know, you're only getting married because you can't control yourself. Now, what are we to say to that? I want to say yes and no to that. Yes and no. First of all, no, because he said it's a matter of giftedness. And if you don't have the gift, you don't have the gift. That's fine. There's no use trying to do something you're not gifted for. But I also want to say yes, to some regard, in that the shock that we feel there where he says, oh, if you can't control yourself, get married, it just seems to, you know, be degrading of marriage. But I say, no, it's not degrading of marriage. Because for most people, they've put marriage up on a pedestal. They've actually made it like an idol and put it in a place where it should not be. You see, what Paul is saying here is that we should use our marriages to promote godly lives for our partners. And that that what really matters is keeping God's commands. What really matters is living as a Christian and living for God. And so our marriages should serve that purpose. And so it may sound shocking when he says this about marriage, but that's because we've elevated marriage too high. We need to humble it and put it in its right position, that living for God and serving God, whether you're married or single, that's what matters. And your marriage should serve you serving your partner. But I actually think that that's a really great goal to have for marriage. I think that is a fantastic goal to have for marriage. See, when I married my wife, it was because I thought she was just the most beautiful woman in the world, and my goal was just to marry her, to get her. I wanted this woman. But now that I am married, I realise that she's still the most beautiful woman in the world, but she listened to these tapes, and... but it's also that through me looking after her and her looking after me, we actually look after each other, we protect each other, we encourage each other to live the godly life, and she saves me by allowing me to express my sexual instincts in a godly way. And I think that's actually a great goal to have, and it actually shows that marriage serves a higher purpose than just itself. Now, he does say that if you're burning with passion, you should get married. And if you are burning with passion, then pray for the gift of singleness. But, you know, look for a marriage partner. That's not an easy thing to do. It may be easy, may not be easy. But that's what you need to do. Find a spouse. Now, how do we wait? How do we wait as Christians while we wait to get married? Well, first of all, don't stir yourself up sexually. If you've got the sexual feelings and they're given to you by God, which they are, don't stir them up if you're not married. So, for instance, if you're reading erotic stories or you're looking at pornography, that's actually stirring you up. And that's not a good way to not be frustrated sexually, is it? You know, if you look at pornography, you read erotic stories, you're going to get frustrated sexually. So just don't read them. Don't look at it. The other thing is to think modestly and to dress modestly. But I think the most important thing is to disciple yourself to become a godly man or woman in preparation for your marriage. That's the most important thing, to think, how can I become a godly husband? You know, whenever, and God willing, that when that day comes and I do get married, what can I be doing for myself now? And basically it's to be growing as a Christian, to be maturing as a Christian, so that when you do get married, you'll continue that service attitude to your spouse. Okay, we'll quickly look at this other one. The second application to Christian couples, verses 10 to 11. To the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. Now here we see that there's a responsibility in marriage. And if you separate from someone, for whatever reason it may be, that you're actually... to still look after that person. Right, very often when there's divorces or separations, people hate each other, want to destroy each other. But what he's saying here is that if you separate, you're not to remarry, and instead you're meant to be seeking reconciliation. And again, this is for the husband to the wife or the wife to the husband. And so there's still even a looking after that person, even in that very troubled time of your marriage. Now, the reason for that is if you actually divorce them, then Jesus said, and he refers to Jesus in the first part of that verse, Jesus said that if you divorce a woman, you cause her to sin because she's going to have to most likely get married somewhere else. And so you've forced her to break a marriage and to remarry when she shouldn't have done that. And so when you divorce people, you're actually forcing them to sin. He's saying, you know, we shouldn't use our marriages to make other people sin. So we should be looking for reconciliation or just staying separate. So that's what he says with to Christian couples. But again, we see marriage is being used even for the care of the other person. What about the next section in verses 12 to 13? To the rest, I say this, I, not the Lord. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband and he is not a believer and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. Now, what's he talking about here? He's talking about a Christian who's married to a non-Christian. Remember that as the gospel went out, it went out to people who were idolaters, they worshipped all types of gods, and sometimes just the husband or the wife would become a Christian. And so you'd find yourself in a situation where you're married to someone who worships a different god. They might be bowing down to idols. But here, there's still even a responsibility in marriage, where Paul says, you're not to divorce them. You're to stay with them if they're prepared to stay with you. His reason is given in verse 14. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. Now that can sound a bit odd when you read it, all about husbands being sanctified by the believing wife and children being holy. But what he's saying is that, he's comparing it to the Old Testament. And in the Old Testament, if you were a Jew and you married someone who worshipped another god, you had to break that marriage off. There was no two ways about it. You had to break it off because they were unclean. And the children born of that marriage would be unclean, illegitimate. But what he's saying is, in the gospel age, it's different. And because God's calling people in different situations, some of them are married to unbelievers, some of them are married to believers, some of them are single. You know, there's all these who are being called from all different places, but God has made holy the place that you're in. And so even if you're married to an unbeliever, that is still holy. It's still sanctified. It doesn't mean the person's a Christian just because they're married to you, a believer, but it means that your marriage is still valid and your children are still legitimate children. And so you're not to divorce them. Well, he finishes up by coming back to this idea of where God has called you. And we've started to see this now. Look at verse 17. He says, "Nevertheless, each one should retain the place in life that the Lord assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is the rule I lay down in all the churches. Was a man already circumcised when he was called? He should not become uncircumcised. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called? He should not become circumcised. Circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts." You see, that this church in Corinth is thinking, well, I'm married to an unbeliever, so I've got to divorce her. Well, I'm single, so I need to get married. Or I'm married, so I shouldn't touch a woman. They're thinking that they can't serve God where they are, that they need to do something to properly serve God. And what Paul is saying here is that's completely wrong. You can serve God exactly where God calls you. But when he's talking about calling there, he's talking about God calling you to become a Christian when you heard the gospel and believed it. And he's saying it doesn't matter where you are when God calls you, you serve God there and then. You don't need to change the situation to serve God. Now, there are some situations where I think that works itself out for us here and that where we need to apply it. You see, for many of you, you come from Christian homes. And when God called you, it was when you had Christian parents and he called you in a Christian house. And you know, you can serve God there. There are some young people who think, oh, you know, I hear about these other Christians. They were prostitutes, on drugs, shooting machine guns, doing all this stuff. And you know me, you know, I was born into a Christian house. I've got a really boring Christian story. I've just been blessed with Christian parents. The way they talk about it, it's almost as if they can't serve God. But that's a load of rubbish. You actually can serve God a lot easier in your house. You might think, I don't have this great conversion story. You've got a fantastic conversion story. You can serve God exactly where you are, and your parents will love it. Serve God where you are. You don't need to have non-Christian parents to really serve God. Some people say to me, well, I want to serve God after I leave uni. Just at the moment, I'm just busy with studies, and when I leave uni, then I'll get serious about God. Then I'll serve. I can't serve God in this situation now. That's nonsense. You need to serve God now. It's not that you think, oh, when I leave. Well, why do you think you'll serve God later if you're not going to do it now? How does that work? That doesn't work. You serve God in the situation that he's called you, and you're now at uni. You serve God here. Another one that sometimes Christians say is, I really want to serve God when I become a Christian leader, when I become a youth group leader, when I become a missionary. Well, when I become a Christian leader, then I'll do it. But now, you know, there's nothing for me to do. You know, I'm not going to serve God now. I'll really do it when I become a Christian, after I've been to Bible college. You know, yeah, it's a load of rubbish. You don't need to go to Bible college. You don't need to become a missionary. You don't need to become a leader in the church. You serve God now. You serve him. You love his people. You don't need to change your situation at all. If you're a mother, some mothers might say, well, you know, I'm just so busy with the kids, I can't serve God here because I'm just, you know, got all these kids running around me, hanging off me. Well, no, you can serve God in that situation. Doesn't matter what situation you're in, you can serve God because this is what Paul says. Each one should stay in the situation and work and serve God in that situation. I guess there's only really one situation which you can't serve God, and that is if you're a sinner and you haven't become a Christian yet. If you've actually been just living life your own way and you don't know God as your Father, well then that would be a legitimate place of saying, I can't serve God. And if that's the case, I want to say, you don't have to live like that. Because God can make you new. God can make you his person. In fact, for most of you, God has made you his person. And you can live for him now, live for him in whatever situation you find yourself. You can live for him for his praise. You can serve God in any situation. Christianity is not about leaving the world, but about living for our Lord wherever you are. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you that you're such a great God who can be worshipped anywhere and everywhere. And we thank you that in all of our situations of life we can serve you. We just pray, Father, for most of us as we're single, that you'll give us the gift of singleness and holiness so that we may live holy in that state. And for those of us who are married, we pray that you'll give us a real servant heart to our spouse so that we can love and serve them properly. And we thank you for this and just pray that we'll always be wanting to serve and look after each other. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.